Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. As the European Central Bank and the G7 finance ministers hold emergency meetings, we'll begin with the possibility of a Black Monday, a financial tsunami cascading across overseas stock exchanges, a global crash which the ministers are attempting to prevent before it reaches our shores. Economist Dean Baker joins us to explain who the Standard & Poor's rating agency are, why they downgraded the US's credit rating, and how they have the power to do so and rattle the world markets. Then we'll go to Israel, where massive demonstrations are shaking the Netanyahu government in what some are describing as Israel's Arab Spring. Gideon Levy, who writes for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, joins us to assess how this useful rebellion, which started as a tent city, has grown into a national protest movement. Then Dallas Morning News senior political reporter Wayne Slater joins us. He covered Saturday's political religious revival meeting in Houston organized by Governor Rick Perry and a group of pastors, many from the New Apostolic Movement. We will look into this new movement on the religious right, as well as the growing possibility that Rick Perry will throw his 10-gallon hat in the Republican presidential ring. Then finally, we'll examine Americans Elect, a new internet-powered third party that is silently sweeping the country and is poised to be on over 50 ballots in next year's election. Third-party veteran organizer Kevin Zeese, who was Ralph Nader's spokesman for his 2004 presidential run, joins us to talk about the well-financed Americans Elect that will conduct virtual primaries in mid-2002 to elect a third-party presidential candidate via the internet. I'm now joined by Dean Baker, who is co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a progressive economic think tank based in Washington, D.C. His books include Taking Economics Seriously, False Profits Recovering from the Bubble Economy, and The Conservative Nanny State, How the Wealthy Use the Government to Stay Rich and Get Even Richer. He also writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dean Baker.
Thanks for having me on.
Dean, do you think that there is going to be a kind of tsunami, a Black Monday? Because already the stock exchanges in the Middle East are down in Israel and Egypt, and the European finance ministers are sort of meeting now, frantically trying to staunch this possible panic.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. But it's nothing to do with the downgrade. The euro is on the edge of collapse. The euro, of course, is next to the dollar, the major currency in the world, and you've had a run already on the debt of the smaller countries, Greece and Ireland and Portugal. And now the latest market numbers indicate the run is spreading to Italy and Spain. So these are very large countries within the Eurozone. It'll be very difficult, or shall we say expensive, not difficult, but expensive to arrange a bailout of those countries. And that's why the market's in turmoil. It's kind of like, you know, I stub my toe and I go, look at that, the markets are tumbling because I just stubbed my... No, that doesn't make any sense. That no one gives a damn about S&P. They know it's a clown outfit.
Well, then why is there so much coverage on the idea that this outfit...
There's a lot of people have an agenda here. Let me just make one point really clear. A couple points. First off, S&P has an absolutely abysmal record. They raided hundreds of billions of dollars of subprime-backed, mortgage-backed securities as investment grade, many of them AAA, back during the housing bubble. They raided AIG AAA till I believe the day it went bankrupt, or would have been bankrupt if the government had bailed it out. So their ability as seers is just about as bad as it could possibly be. But specifically with this downgrade, and I think this tells us just about everything we need to know, they made a $2 trillion error. They're working off the wrong baseline. This is right up on the Treasury Department's website. The Treasury people are going back and forth with S&P, and they realized that they had the wrong baseline. So they said, hey, you need to use the right baseline. You see, if you use the right baseline, then our debt will be $2 trillion less. And S&P said, oh, we don't care. We're still going to downgrade you. Now, this is just like the Iraq War. They decided they wanted to fight the war, and then they came up with the story about weapons of mass destruction. This is the same thing. They wanted to downgrade. This is clearly a political story, and they're going to produce whatever they need in way of evidence after the fact.
So, Dean Baker, can you tell us what their politics are? Who they're acting on the behest of whom? What's going on here?
Well, I mean, I can only speculate. I don't know the people at S&P. I don't know exactly, but you know, let me just give you two stories here. One is that they're very much concerned about the outcome of the Dodd-Frank bill. There's issues still to be resolved that directly have to do with the regulation of the credit rating agencies, and they would certainly like those rules to be done in a favorable way. And they may think this is currying favor, may well be currying favor with politicians, and it could be on both the Democratic and Republican side. The other is, I think it's probably wrong to assume, again, this is a good thing. I wish I could say I thought we had objective credit rating agencies that just called as they saw it. But I think it'd be wrong to assume that that's the case. And they may think they're either helping the Republicans or Democrats or more generally a specific policy agenda with the downgrade. And specifically what I'm thinking of here is that there's going to be renewed calls to larger budget cuts, and particularly cuts to Social Security and Medicare. And these are incredibly popular programs across the political spectrum. It's not a left-right issue. The Tea Party people strongly support Social Security and Medicare. Poll after poll shows that. So the only way you get cuts in these programs is if you say, well, you know, we really have no choice. You know, Standard & Poor's, they downgraded us. Maybe Moody's will. Maybe Fitch will. You know, maybe they'll give us another downgrade. We really have no choice. So certainly Standard & Poor's understands that. Did that affect their decision? We certainly can't rule that out.
So, but in the real world, Dean Baker, what are the markets reacting to? Are they reacting to this politically induced mistake on the part of Standard & Poor's, where their math is short by $2 trillion, yet they're sticking with their story, and apparently they're having some influence, even if you say they're a clown outfit. You know, one has to attribute something to these shockwaves that are going through. Now, are the Wall Street people sticking to their mantra that we've got to get our fiscal house in order, or are they reacting to, which I think is in terms of what's the economic version of realpolitik? In other words, real stuff that's happening. $2 trillion has just been taken out of a sick economy. All economists that I talk to say that this is going to mean a deepening of the recession, and it's the worst possible prescription at this moment. So what are they reacting to? The abstraction of getting our financial house in order, or are they reacting to the real impact of what just happened on Capitol Hill?
Yeah, well, I think it's clear they're reacting to the real impact. There was a concern, and again, we have different markets we could look at. If there was a concern that the U.S. financial house wasn't in order, well, one of the things we'd be expected to see is a fall in bond prices. In other words, interest rates would rise. They went the wrong way. Bond prices have been plunging. They're somewhere, the 10-year yield's around 2.6%. Apart from the very peaks of the financial crisis back in the fall of 2008, it has never been this low. So, you know, the idea that they're worried the fiscal house is out of order, the bonds are saying no, as loud as they can, 180 degrees wrong. We're not at all concerned about that. We've gotten a number of reports in the last couple weeks, particularly the GDP report for the second quarter that came out a week ago Friday, that showed the economy was much weaker than most people had thought. It was barely growing at all in the first quarter and extremely weak growth in the second quarter. And coupled with that, of course, the cutbacks that we have in the debt ceiling agreement, I think people see a weak economy that, you know, holds a real risk of getting even weaker. So that's not surprising that that would be bad news for the markets. Plus, as I say, the real risk in Europe, because there's no way if you have a breakup in the euro, we're very likely to see Lehman-type situations where we have freeze up of the financial system. Now, hopefully, the ECB, European Central Bank, the Fed, and other major banks are prepared for that. I wouldn't take that for granted, but we run a risk of a very serious financial crisis if you see a breakup of the euro, and it's hard to believe that wouldn't have any impact on stock markets here.
So that's the real problem. This S&P report is a part of this kind of economic theater that's going on that has largely been provoked by the Republicans, and it seems to have a political dimension. And certainly the results are political. This weak economy is being weakened even further, which is going to make it more difficult for Obama to get reelected. So, but at the end of the day, in the real economy, what counts is restoring employment and restoring demand, and none of that's happening.
That's right. And also, I should say, I do not know that this agenda serves the Republicans. It was President Obama that put raising the age of Medicare eligibility to 67 on the table in the debt ceiling negotiations. President Obama also put cuts to Social Security on the table. So I, you know, which party this serves, I think there's some extent of bipartisan desire to see Social Security and Medicare cut. Obviously, the Republicans have a goal of getting President Obama out of the White House. But in terms of going after Social Security and Medicare, there's sort of a bipartisan consensus, at least among the leadership in both parties, that they'd like to do that.
So what kind of economic Kool-Aid is the president drinking then? If he thinks that that's a good idea, because Social Security pays for itself, and it is the private part of the of medical costs that's out of control. Medicare is not anywhere near as a budget buster as the private healthcare system is.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't assume that there's an economic philosophy here. I think the idea is that money that goes to middle class people is money that could be in the pockets of the wealthy. And I don't think there's anything more than that to it. So I think that's what's going on in efforts to cut Social Security and Medicare. Why should middle-class people, poor people, get the money when it could be going to the wealthy?
So are you suggesting then, Dean Baker, that both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party are competing to be the party of the oligarchs?
Well, I think to some extent that's absolutely true. I mean, look, both parties know they have to raise large amounts of money to win a presidential, for that matter, the Congress, win or hold the Congress. And that means getting a lot of campaign contributions from people with money. I mean, that's sort of straightforward, right? So they have to say things that favor the wealthy. And so in that sense, yes. I mean, obviously at the end of the day, they're also going to need votes. But I think their view, and it's probably a correct view, is that first and foremost, they need the money to get in the race, and after that, they'll figure out how to, you know, tell people that they should vote for them.
But Dean Baker, you've surely seen these latest polls where 82% of the American people are critical of what just happened on Capitol Hill, and they feel that the emphasis is misplaced on Social Security and Medicare, and that getting jobs should be the economic priority.
This is hugely unpopular with the public. I mean, the public wants to see, you know, Congress and President focus on creative jobs. The last thing on earth they want to see are cutbacks to Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. And again, I should point out that's across the board. That's Tea Party people, not just liberal Democrats. They don't want to see those programs cut. They think they're good programs. They know that people depend on them. So it's hugely unpopular, but it wins enormous support among campaign contributors. And also, I should point out, in the media. I mean, Washington Post is, you know, just ecstatic that people might cut Social Security and Medicare. And in their news pages, I don't just mean their editorials. I mean, you'll get praised there. You know, National Public Radio, same thing. So they're playing a political game. I'm sure they understand that these are unpopular with the public. But again, if they both parties are in on it, you know, that's what they keep talking about. We want bipartisan, bipartisan, bipartisan. So that way they could tell the public, well, what are you going to do? The Republicans were there too. The Democrats were there too. What are you going to do? Where are you going to go, Ralph Nader?
Well, we're going to be talking about Americans Elect later in the internet.
You're on that too, by the way.
he's Peter Ackerman from Drexel Burnham. At least he has that in his past, in his CV. But just in closing then, Dean Baker, in essence, what you're saying here is that in this upcoming 2012 election, that Wall Street money is more important than the votes of the vast majority of the American people. I don't understand that part. If 82% of the American people are fed up and angry with what's just happened and feel their priorities are wrong, and that
you can't organize them. It takes money to do it. You'll be ridiculed by the Washington Post, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal. When they aren't ignoring you, they'll go back and forth. You can't organize them, or at least not very easily. So, I mean, yes, that's exactly right, that you have the Republicans and Democrats saying, look, we're going to get a pile of money from rich people, and we know what we're doing is unpopular. Go try and do something about it.
Well, what can I say? We have a year and a half before the verdict is in, but just in the immediate short term, Monday you think is going to be a bad day.
I think so, most likely because, again, the situation with the euro. Now, in the event that the European Central Bank finally gets its act together and is prepared to say, look, we're going to do what's necessary to keep the euro together, and if that means, you know, throwing tons of money, which is basically what it means at the end of the day, we're going to do that, then I think we'll see the markets rally. But that's really the big factor right now, because that the prospect of the euro breaking up, you know, that's going to be an earthquake in financial markets. And, you know, the S&P, they downgraded Japan's government debt back in, I think it was 2002. If you look at the movement in Japanese interest rates, you couldn't even find that downgrade. And today, Japan's interest rate on 10-year bonds is a little over 1%. So the markets were not terribly impressed by that downgrade, and I think it would be the same with this one.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, Dean Baker.
Thanks for having me on.
Again, I've been joined by Dean Baker, who's co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a progressive economic think tank in Washington, D.C. His books include Taking Economics Seriously, False Prophets, Recovering from the Bubble Economy, and The Conservative Nanny State, How the Wealthy Use the Government to Stay Rich and Get Richer. He also writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press. We're going to take a brief station break, and then we'll be back talking with a reporter from Haaretz in Israel.
Singing high times ain't gonna rule my mind. High times ain't gonna rule my mind, Bessie. High times ain't gonna rule my mind no more.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Gideon Levy, who is an Israeli journalist who writes for Haaretz and is the former spokesman for Shimon Peres. His books include Twilight Zone, Life and Death Under the Israeli Occupation, and The Punishment of Gaza. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gideon Levy.
Thank you so much.
And many analysts are describing what is happening now in Israel is an Israeli version of the Arab Spring. How did this youthful rebellion, which started as a tent city, grow into such a national protest movement with one of the biggest demonstrations in Israel's history in the streets?
Yeah, I think yesterday it was the biggest demonstration ever in Tel Aviv. It started like all those so-called revolutions start, gradually, in the most unexpected time, by the most unexpected generation. It started about the prices of cottage cheese, and gradually it became a protest against the cost of living and about the cost of housing. But now it's much broader than this, and hundreds of thousands of Israelis are now, the third Saturday, week after week, going to the streets and expressing their protest against the life standard in Israel, against the prices, against the tycoons, and against the government.
Well, my understanding is that Israel is second in the world to the United States, which leads the world in this, with the dubious distinction of having the greatest disparity in wealth between the a few people at the very top who have most of the wealth and a growing number at the bottom who have less and less. That, given that Israel started out as this kind of socialist experiment, it's fairly hard to understand how things have changed that radically.
Yeah, I guess this list concerns to the Western world, because I guess that in the third world there are much bigger gaps.
Oh, I would think, exactly. In the industrial world, not in terms of dictatorships in the third world. Yeah,
exactly.
But just, go ahead.
Still, it's very worrying, and it's a new phenomena, because back in my childhood, there were almost no rich ones and almost no poor ones, and we were more or less quite equal. I remember from my childhood, I grew up in Tel Aviv in quite a middle-class neighborhood, and we were all equal. This changed mainly in the last years, thanks to a very aggressive, capitalistic policy of the right-wing government. And here we are with those gaps, with middle class, which is paying more and more and getting less and less. And I think this is what brought the people finally, after many years of total apathy and indifference, this brought finally the people to the streets.
So what contributed to this, though? Again, Gideon Levy, Israeli journalist who writes for Haaretz, we're talking about these massive demonstrations in Israel that began with a youthful protest in tent cities on the wealthiest shopping street and in front of the prime minister's residence, now growing into a massive popular movement with the largest demonstrations in Israel's history. Now, two factors seem to, at least to my mind, be at play here. One is the influx of immigrants from the former Soviet Union who came out of a socialist experiment which they were fleeing from, and two, the growth and power of Israeli tycoons, many of whom are also Americans, like Sheldon Adelson, who not only is spending a lot of money on West Bank settlements, along with Moskowitz here in Southern California, who owns the Bicycle Club Casino. My understanding is that Adelson has become kind of Israel's Rupert Murdoch, with a kind of right-wing Fox News type television operation that is also, you know, pushing the country to the right.
Yeah, but I think the main problem is a very local one, and the big families, the rich families, are Israeli families. The names you just mentioned are around, but I don't think the problem is just because of them. I think that the Israeli society had grown into a situation in which very few families are holding much too much. All of them are local families. And they made their money quite rapidly, and the gaps became deeper and deeper. One should remember that the unemployment rate in Israel is very low, very, very low, much better than in most of the countries in the West. But the problem is that people who work cannot make it. It's not about unemployment, it's about very low salaries and very high costs. Also, the prices in Israel, now we realize, are much higher than in the West. You can compare any product from McDonald's to Coca-Cola, from washing machine to washing powder, and you will realize that we in Israel pay more than in most of the countries in the world, and the profits go to those tycoons. All this is, from now on, unacceptable.
But isn't there a dimension, though, with housing? This is about... the reason they're in tents is that they can't afford housing. And what I understand a lot of the protesters are saying is that our government is spending all of this money subsidizing West Bank housing, which is obviously causing political problems since it's on disputed territory, and that's a big part of the protest. And indeed... I understand that the Hilltop Youth, the right-wing settlers, have joined in the protest in order to co-opt and distract that very anger.
Unfortunately, this is not the case, because the protest, until now at least, is not aimed against the settlements and the enormous sums of money which go to the settlements. And I say unfortunately so, because... people still don't see the connection between the construction of settlements and the social services, which are getting worse and worse. Same about also the defense budget, which is huge in Israel and not always necessary to be so huge. But people don't do yet the connection between the money that goes there and the money that lacks here. So the protest, by all means, is not directed against the settlements. And this is very unfortunate. So
I've got it wrong then, at least, that the Hilltop youth then are an equal part of this coalition, because I'd seen reports that many of the protesters in the tent cities felt that that the Hilltop youth were jumping on the bandwagon to distract from some of the core issues.
No, a very small group of them joined for one or two days, mm-hmm. and they put some tents. Along hundreds of tents in the center of Tel Aviv, but it was more of a provocation, and you can't say that they are part of it, because it was really just a very symbolic number of few young settlers who came there, and they were partly rejected, not enough, but you can't say that they are part of this protest, by all means not.
So tell me then, because I'd read some of your pieces that you've written about this, Gideon Levy, again, journalist with Haaretz, that you felt a certain pride for the first time. You felt that the Israeli left that had been sort of demoralized and dormant was coming back. But that's not what you're saying now.
No, I was very proud of being an Israeli, because I saw after many, many years of apathy, of the Israeli society being really in a status of coma, that this society wakes up, and this by itself is a lot. Still, it's not aimed to the right aims, I think, this protest. But the fact that there is some kind of protest, any kind of protest, means a lot in a society which was so apathetic and so indifferent. And also the very democratic nature of this protest makes me feel very good about Israel, because it's really a very, very democratic protest. Those young people who are leading it are getting their decisions in a very democratic way. There is no violence whatsoever, and this makes a big difference from the Arab Spring. Neither the police, nor the army, nor the protesters are using any kind of violence. And to see hundreds of thousands of Israelis going to the streets, screaming, calling for the fall of this government, and doing it in a very democratic way, that's a good reason to feel very proud. I wish this protest would have been aimed also to some other targets, like ending the occupation, like putting an end to the settlements, but this does not happen. And still, I think it is a very, very fascinating beginning of a people who wakes up.
Well, just in the last minute here, what is happening with Netanyahu and his response? Because prior to this, there was speculation, and you probably know about the former Mossad head, Maya Dagan, saying that Netanyahu's sort of getting paranoid and under siege and doesn't know what to do about the Palestinian declaration of statehood in September, and he's likely to strike out and maybe even attack Iran. That speculation I've been looking into as well. But you would think if that was the case, then Netanyahu's even under even more pressure and is feeling even more besieged. So are we going to see a war to distract us?
I don't think so. I don't think so, because this will not be accepted by the Israeli people right now. Attack on Iran will also not get the approval of the United States, and without the approval of the United States, it's out of the question. It's really more of a kind of speculation, not to say conspiration theory. I don't think that Netanyahu can do much about it. The Israeli people will not accept it. It will be accepted. And this is also maybe a new development, that people will be much more critical and much more suspicious. And I don't think right now this is on the table. It might develop there, but there are no signs that this is the direction.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Gideon Levy.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Gideon Levy, who's an Israeli journalist who writes for Haaretz and is the former spokesman for Shimon Peres. His books include Twilight Zone, Life and Death Under the Israeli Occupation, and The Punishment of Gaza. Let's now turn to our own apocalyptic politics, if you will. I'm joined by Wayne Slater, who is a senior political writer for the Dallas Morning News, a position he was appointed to after 15 years as Austin bureau chief. He's the co-author with James Moore of the New York Times bestseller Bush's Brain, How Karl Rove Made George W. Bush Presidential, which was made into a feature documentary. Wayne Slater has covered every Republican and Democratic National Convention since 1988 and the administration of Texas Governors Bill Clement, Ann Richards, George W. Bush, and Rick Perry. Welcome to Background Briefing, Wayne Slater.
It's always wonderful to be on with you, Ian.
And Wayne, you were on Saturday down there in Houston at the Reliance Stadium for this political religious meeting. It seemed to be a fusion of a revival meeting and a possible presidential toe in the water for Rick Perry. Give us your impressions of it.
It was an extraordinary event. It really was. I mean, this was at a football stadium, Reliance Stadium, where the Texans NFL football team play. 30,000 people, maybe more, showed up. It was a seven-hour nonstop revival meeting where you had prayer, where you had songs, and where you had fairly brief speeches or sermons or sermonettes, including one by Rick Perry. What you saw were evangelicals, Texas evangelicals for the most part, but people came from other, bussed in from other places, who were listening to the music, holding their hands up. It looked like exactly what happens at hundreds, maybe thousands of evangelical churches across the country. And yet there was this political message in the context of a claim that this was not political, and that was our government is broken, things are bad, but the solution is to ask God to fix it.
And is God's representative on earth Rick Perry, since he organized it? And I understand that many of the pastors who belong to this new apostolic reformation who organized it have basically seen him as thus. Back in 2009, two Texas pastors told Rick Perry, a chain of powerful prophecies had proclaimed that Texas was the prophet state anointed by God to lead the United States into revival and godly government, and that the governor would have a special role.
What I think that's taken me a bit to understand is that these are not people. We tend to think that the critics of the Washington and spending or government policy with respect to gay marriage or abortion and the social and populist fiscal themes, we tend to think of these people as people who want less government, especially the populist Tea Party types. In fact, or maybe in some cases, virtually no government. That's not who these people are. These people want a different kind of government, a government that's more Christological, that's more Christ-centric, a government that follows basically biblical principles, biblical rules, even in some cases, the idea of biblical law. And several of these folks see Rick Perry as exactly the kind of public figure, as they get more active in the political process from a religious platform, that Perry is the kind of political figure who represents their goal of having a biblically guided government. If you will, it would be literally a government, a one nation under God, literally.
Well, apparently, according to the manifesto of the New Apostolic Reformation and a number of the people involved in its formation, Peter Wagner and Cindy Jacobs, Lou Engel were a part of this group, along with Donald Wildman, the pastor who was also one of the organizers, who believes that. That Christians only are, I mean, he believes in a Christian theocracy here in the United States, and that the Constitution and the Bill of Rights do not pertain to other religions but Christian. So they're talking here about a dominion over government, but their terms, they use the term the seven mountains of society, which include the media and the arts and the entertainment world. But the first one, of course, is the political one, where they have to find a leader to lead, an army of God to command a civilian government.
Well, now, you know, we shouldn't mislead the folks who listen to your show. I've covered Rick Perry, been around Rick Perry for 20 years. He is a conventional, if very conservative, Republican chief executive, or a chief executive of a state. I don't for a minute believe that Rick Perry himself would establish a theocracy, if he were president of the United States. What I do believe is that he is a religiously, he has a deep religious faith, and that he sees politically the advantage of associating himself and reflecting the idea, at least, that he could be the candidate of Christian conservatives, social conservatives, who were so important in the early primary and caucus states, Iowa, South Carolina, and Florida. And the thing that the Perry people really have understood, and Rick Perry was one of the first people in the country, political, state-level or national political figures, to recognize the importance of the rise of the Tea Party back in 2009. And he jumped aboard, and I think he really saw what was happening. And what was happening in this case is that people tend to think of evangelicals as folks who care about social issues, the abortion, gay marriage, religious expression, and that the Tea Party is a fiscal, a culturally fiscal operation who care about spending and government, anti-Washington, and so forth. What Perry's team understands, I think, is that there is an enormous overlap, or there is a significant overlap between these two sides. These are the evangelicals, folks who believe in absolute terms with respect to the social issues, but also believe passionately and absolutely that spending issues, that Washington, that taking our money for some other purpose is theft. They believe almost in the same kind of absolute moral terms in those. These evangelicals who have both the social and the religious agenda that they hold important are the target that Rick Perry's aiming at right now. And while the Christian conservatives were on display yesterday for 7 hours, and I was in the hall for 7 hours at the rally, it is these Christian conservative evangelicals who Rick Perry thinks are his ticket to the Republican nomination.
And did you coin that word, evangelical?
I probably heard it somewhere. But it's a good one,
Wayne.
Yeah, I think some people say I did.
Again, I'm speaking with Wayne Slater, a senior political writer for the Dallas Morning News. He was at the religious political rally that Governor Rick Perry of Texas organized. And, of course, Rick Perry's ads are being played in Iowa. Whether or not he's sanctioned it, it's an outside group of Texas backers of him that are funding this apparently fairly extensive ad campaign in Iowa. And, of course, the coming week is a big week for Iowa, culminating next weekend with the straw poll. They'll be having another debate there early in the week. But you've defended Perry from the theocracy charge, but he has actually, Wayne, he's talked about secession, which is, I think, to be fair, pretty irresponsible, given we had a civil war over that issue.
Although that is a kind of religious sense to it.
Right. But he also, in the galleys of this his autobiography, which I don't know that he's going to publish now, he apparently is against the 16th Amendment and the 17th Amendment. And the 17th Amendment, of course, is the amendment prior to that. Senators were not directly elected by the people of this country. They were elected by the legislatures, all of which were heavily influenced by railroad barons, etc. So there's no question that the 17th Amendment was one of the healthiest things that ever happened to American democracy. How could this guy be against it?
There are two things that are interesting that grow out of this. There is a significant group of conservative heritage Heritage Group in Washington and other conservatives who sort of espoused this idea, which I didn't know about until I really read what Rick Perry had written. And it is all part of the idea of having the state, changing the way we pick our senators and return to the idea that legislatures would be involved. It really is all part of an idea that comes out of the 10th Amendment. That's the states' rights idea, that states should have more responsibility than that they should be doing more, that Washington has been infringing on the rights of the states in too many areas. And so the idea that he would recommend this really grows out of a larger, just sort of general idea that government should be local, that the state is being infringed upon by Washington, and that states' rights is a significant call. And in this case, the legislatures, a government closer to home, would be involved in the selection process. You're right in your history. It really would, in many ways, seem to be a return to something that was corrupt. But I think, as someone has said, and I've repeated it, these people love the Constitution, so let's change it all the time. Let's change these various amendments that we don't like about abortion, gay marriage, the selection of senators, and so forth. But it all comes out of this states' rights idea. Now, the second thing that makes this interesting is that I think this whole commitment to states' rights, which Perry espouses as a religion, which is very popular here in the South, has gotten him in trouble recently. He in his presidential bid, and I think has indicated, or at least has raised the possibility, that he may not be ready for prime time after all. Not long ago, in a meeting a panel in Aspen, maybe a month ago or so, he was asked about New York passing. Approving passing gay marriage. And he said, fine. That's fine with him. States ought to have the right to do what they want to do. And he was espousing his states' rights position as a conservative mantra. The problem is that collided head on with another conservative mantra, the social conservative requirement, opposition to gay marriage. And in this case, to make a long story real short, he backed off. When those two fundamental ideas in the Republican political world collided, the social, religious, conservative opposition to gay marriage was where he ended up, saying that, no, he would approve a constitutional amendment that would ban gay marriage. In other words, he's for states' rights, except when he's against states' rights.
Right.
Or states' rights, except when you accept in
case. Right. Well, I guess the politician got the better of the pastor in that case.
I think so. Yeah, that's pretty good. Yeah.
But I thank you for joining us here, Wayne.
It's great to be with you.
It's good to be with you again. I was speaking then with Wayne Slater, senior political writer for the Dallas Morning News, and he's the co-author with Jim Moore of the New York Times bestseller Bush's Brain, How Karl Rove Made George W. Bush Presidential. He's covered every Republican and Democratic National Convention since 1988 and the administration of Texas governors Bill Clements, Ann Richards, George W. Bush, and Rick Perry. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about this stealth new party called Americans Elect that looks like they'll be running a third-party candidate via the Internet next year.
Soldier of the cross, soldier of the cross, you carry the sword of faith. Soldier of the cross, soldier of the cross, you bring love to those who hate. You bring love to those who hate. Who are you?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is attorney and activist Kevin Zeese, who is the co-director of It's Our Economy, director of Come Home America. He also serves on the steering committee of the Bradley Manning Support Network and the October2011.org. He has been active in third-party electoral politics. He served as Ralph Nader's press secretary and spokesman in 2004, ran for Maryland's United States Senate seat on the Green Party ticket in 2006, and was the only person ever nominated by the Green Party, Libertarian Party, and Populist Party. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kevin Zeese.
Thanks for having me on, Ian.
And Kevin, you've got third-party credentials. There's no two ways about it. But what kind of credentials does Peter Ackerman have, who's behind this Americans Elect process, which is going on? Apparently, it's going on pretty much under the radar. They're on their way to getting on all 50 ballots. They're going to conduct a virtual primary in mid-2012 to elect via the internet a presidential candidate to run against Barack Obama and whoever the Republican nominee is. So tell me.
Well, his major credential is he has the money to make this happen. And that's, I think, one of the problems in our politics is money dominates. And Ackerman comes out of money management businesses and is putting millions of dollars into this effort, has found some other funders that are undisclosed to join him. And they're in the process of getting on all 50 state ballots, which is really a great thing to do. There's a real challenge for third parties to get on the ballot, and most don't have the resources that Ackerman and his other money managers have to do it. There's a great desire for a third choice in American politics. People feel more and more manipulated by the two-party system where the corporations approve the candidates for both parties, and then we're stuck picking a corporate-approved candidate. So there's a great desire for this. Whether or not this is the answer, I think, is still a question that's in the air. Ackerman has not disclosed the other funders, so we don't know what their agendas are. Ackerman has a mixed political history. He's been very much a force in the nonviolence movement around the world, which is an interesting credential. But he's also been active with people like the Cato Institute and saying things like the Social Security system is on its way to failure, when in fact the trustees say it's in pretty good shape. And he was advocating a privatization of Social Security. I don't know whether he still supports that. What I find disheartening, in addition to the lack of transparency, is the desire for a centrist party that has a ticket of a Republican and a Democrat, you know, one as president, one as vice president. I don't see that as a real third choice. We already have two centrist parties. Yes, they have Dennis Kucinich in the Democratic Party and Ron Paul in the Republican Party, but those are voices that are barely heard, really, in party politics. Both parties are dominated by corporate-approved candidates, and they will both run to the center to try to get the center vote, and that seems to be what Ackerman's strategy is as well. We need a party that actually stands for something. And when you look at polls of Americans, they stand in the center left, not in the center. And the center has become more and more right wing as the Tea Party's gotten undue public attention and undue political power. And instead of moving to where the public is, we've moved away from where the public is. And so I don't see this, from where I see it right now, helping that. I hope it does, but right now I don't see it.
Well, it's worth noting here, I mean, Kevin Zeese, that, you know, the vital center, which is what Tom Friedman's been endorsing this group, Americans Elect, in his columns. You know, it's worth asking, you know, what is a centrist position on Afghanistan, for example? I mean, I understand exactly what you just said is what rules American politics. You know, the Democrats run to the left in the primaries and move back to the center in the general, and the Republicans run to the right in the primaries and move back to the center. But I still don't I don't know what a centrist ticket would be.
Exactly.
Do you have any ideas?
What centrist political positions would be?
Exactly. I mean, I give you Afghanistan as an example. You know, what's the centrist position on that?
Well, the majority position, I guess that would be centrist, is to be getting out of Afghanistan much more quickly. The majority position opposes the war in Libya. The majority position wants us completely out of Iraq, and they want to see massive cuts in military spending. Now, would those be considered centrist by Ackerman or by a Republican and Democrat running under the Ackerman banner? I don't know if that's what he means by centrist. I just finished an article that's going up today on October2011.org, which is an effort to create a Tahrir Square in Freedom Plaza in Washington, D.C., that reviews seven issues and essentially defines where the American public is on those seven issues. So if you want to see what centrist stands for when it comes to wages and unions, the environment and energy and the future economy, Social Security and health care, that article will tell you where the public is. And the public is center-left of what the media tells us is center. So,
absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the latest poll reacting to this deal that was made in Washington, D.C. over the debt crisis, the engineered debt crisis, albeit, 82% of the public think the government's got it all wrong, that they should be focusing on employment, not on cutting Social Security and Medicare. So it'd be interesting to see where Ackerman would be on that. But
that's
just
exactly the point. That's exactly the point I'm making in the October2011.org article. The public is totally different than where the government is. And it's supposed to be a representative democracy.
Right.
It does not represent the people's interests. That's why there's a desire for a third party. We want the people's interests represented. That's not done by either party. It's not going to be done by a centrist with a Republican and Democrat or Democrat-Republican ticket.
Well, particularly if you don't even know who's on the board of the so-called the Hancock Society, which are the everybody that puts up $500,000, and they're not don't have to be revealed. That's the sort of the board of directors, if you will, of American Select. But we'll see more, obviously, as we head towards next year. Obviously, we'll learn more. But just in general, though, you work for Ralph Nader and ran the 2004 campaign as their spokesman. So my question is, as a veteran of the third parties, and we know there's a lot of clamor now for third parties and a primary challenge from the left of the Democratic Party against Obama, which would be similar to what happened to Jimmy Carter with the challenge by Senator Kennedy, which, of course, helped elect Reagan, in arguably your former candidate, Ralph Nader, helped elect George W. Bush in 2000. That seems to be the fate of third parties, that they end up being spoilers. Just explain to me, though, this. How could it be that a small group, even though it's, I think, an AstroTurf operation, the Tea Party, how could the Republican Party be captured by the far right and move the country so precipitously to the left and yet to the right, and yet on the left, the Democratic Party, which many argue has sold its soul to Wall Street, is, you know, floundering, and it's an empty shell.
The difference is that the Republican Party, they are funded by big business interests, and the Tea Party supports the agenda of big business interests. They came out, in fact, against the Obama health care law because it was too tough on the insurance industry, when, in fact, it will give the insurance industry more money and more power and more entrenchment. So they came out with a business agenda, and the funders of business. In the Democratic Party, you have two different things. You have voters who are left of center, who oppose big business domination, who oppose Wall Street, who oppose the wars, and you have funders who support all that business agenda. So the Democrats are divided, trying to get the money, while in order to get the money, they try to manipulate things so they can take their voters for granted because they have nowhere else to go. On this spoiler issue, spoilerism is an essential part of American politics. It's how we ended slavery. Abolition movements got nowhere until they challenged the two corporate parties of that era, the Whigs and the Democrats. It's how we got unions. It's how we got women voting. It always takes an outside third party challenging the two existing parties to move the transformative agenda. If you don't do that, you're stuck within the confines of the business interests of the status quo, and you're not going to see any change. If we had McCain in office versus Obama, we would not see very much of a different agenda as we see now. What we see, a lot more protest on the left against McCain than we do against Obama.
Well, Kevin, I'm afraid we've run out of time, and we're going to have to revisit this because there's a lot more to talk about, and we barely scratched the surface. And I thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
Again, I've been speaking with Kevin Zeese, attorney activist. He has a group called October2011.org. He served as Ralph Nader's press secretary and spokesman in 2004, ran for Maryland's U.S. Senate seat on a Green Party ticket in 2006, and was the only person ever nominated by the Green Party, Libertarian Party, and Populist Party. So what did we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began talking about whether or not tomorrow, Monday, will be a Black Monday on the financial markets around the world as they unravel in Europe. They've already started in the Middle East, and actually Asia will be next, and then Europe and the European Financial Bank, the Central Bank, and the G7 finance ministers are all in emergency meetings trying to prevent it before it hits the United States. In part, of course, it has something to do with the Standard & Poor's rating agency downgrading the U.S. Credit rating. So we talked about these issues with economist Dean Baker, who basically said Standard & Poor's is a joke, and how could the people who rated AIG and all of these Wall Street crooks who took the economy down as being creditworthy, even the day before the crash of AIG, and what's the political motives behind it? And I asked him, well, what are they? And he said that he thinks that maybe Standard & Poor's is trying to scuttle the Dodd-Frank bill, get rid of Obama, get rid of the Dodd-Frank bill, because the Dodd-Frank bill wants to reform these credit agencies for the very reasons that I just mentioned. Then we went to Israel and talked with Gideon Levy with a big paper there, Haaretz. He's been covering these youthful demonstrations that have turned, starting out with a tent city, that have now grown into massive national protests. And basically, it's about the economy, stupid. You know, it's about how billionaires have taken over the country, and there's a lot of employment. There's no unemployment in Israel, but people simply don't make enough money. It started actually over the price of cottage cheese. And in many ways, it makes you wonder why the hell here in the United States we're not taking to the streets in the same way and demonstrating for better living conditions and for more economic fairness. So essentially, the one question I wanted to ask him, I did ask him, was, is Netanyahu under siege going to strike out and start another war, perhaps with Iran? And he said, no, he doesn't think that's on the cards. The Israeli people would not stand for it. Then we talked to Dallas Morning News senior political reporter Wayne Slater about Saturday's political religious revival meeting in Houston organized by Governor Rick Perry, who's clearly running for presidents, and he's winning, you know, he's sewing up the evangelical wing of the religious right. And he thought that the event was actually quite impressive, well organized, very slick. And then I asked him about some of Perry's crazy statements, like secession, being opposed to the 17th Amendment, which is the direct elections of the popular elections of senators. Imagine being against that. In the old days, of course, the legislature supported the U.S. senators, and whoever owned the legislature ended up owning the Senate. So he basically said, now it's all about states' rights. That's what goes back to the 10th Amendment. That's what Perry's already about. Of course, he got into trouble recently where he said that because New York passed the gay marriage thing, well, that's states' rights. And then, of course, the religious right came down on him. He changed his mind. Finally, we spoke with Kevin Zeese, who ran Ralph Nader's 2004 presidential campaign, about the possibility of a third party, which is a lot of talk about now, but mostly about Americans Elect, this new internet-powered third party that's getting on all the ballots, heavily financed. We try to figure out who are they, what do they stand for, who's behind them, what's their agenda. And frankly, there's a lot of mystery surrounding them, but they are making tremendous headway. And clearly, we're going to have to revisit this subject and revisit Kevin Zeese, because he really does know a lot about third parties, and people are really upset with the two that we have now. I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.